This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Do you know what went down at the Viper Room the night River Phoenix died? Are you aware of how Steve McQueen escaped death at the hands of the Manson family? But what about the real-life brutal murder that inspired David Lynch's Twin Peaks? These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
We're off and rolling midweek hump day. April 9, 2025 is the date. Welcome in to the Gabe Kuhn Show. I am your host, former Memphis Tiger, Gabe Kuhn on XIG_Kuhn71. I'm alongside the executive producer of the show. That'd be Connor Dunning on XIC Dunning 99. Connor, how's it going, brother?
What's up, man?
Nothing much. I was concerned yesterday. I was taking my post-show walk. Connor passed me because we're out here in East Memphis, for those that don't know. And Connor, with me taking my post-show walk, had to call me and check on me and see if I was okay. I was trying to better myself, and Connor had to ask me if I was going through a crisis in my life. So I found that pretty interesting yesterday.
Well, the visual from me, it was just funny because I was driving down a street. I won't say which street to keep
sure.
privacy.
Sure.
And I saw you walking, and you were looking up at the sky.
So I had a contemplative look on
and,
my face.
Yeah, and I think you were wearing flip-flops?
No. I was wearing shoes.
You were wearing shoes. Okay. It was just, it looked like you had something on your mind. I didn't see Taylor anywhere. I didn't see the baby anywhere. I didn't see any dogs. And I was like, I just had to make sure my guy was okay.
Be fair, I always have something on my mind.
The way you were looking up at the sky, I was like, oh no, is something going on? Did a dog? It also looked like that maybe a dog had gotten out. Maybe you had tried going to get one.
I just had
to make sure my guy was all right.
It did make me wonder though, because it's like, how bad is it? Like, what type of life do I lead where I'm trying to better myself and someone's like, are you all right? Like, are you okay? I'm getting some exercise. Is everything going all right in your life? Are you having a crisis? You need to talk about it.
I'm gonna be honest. Hand up, the exercise thing never crossed my mind. I was just like, you had this contemplative look on your face. You were walking. It was after the show.
And if you thought I had flip flops on, to completely understand.
I was in a car moving.
Yes, I didn't have shoes on. I had my walking shoes or running shoes, even though I don't run in them. I had my running shoes on, so there was that. I had a nice little 1.5-2 mile walk. That's all that was. But it was nice. It was nice weather out.
It was beautiful.
It was very nice weather. Also, I have to mention this. Did you take advantage of the omelet bar here at the 92.9 studios this morning?
No, I was not here this morning.
I was thinking about it. Where does an omelet bar rank among, like, sort of food stations? If you're, like, going to a buffet, something like that. Like, I always like the prime rib station at a buffet. But the omelet bar, I think, I don't want to put it at number one because maybe I'm overlooking something. But it's got to be up there. It's probably top three among, like, food stations that you get at a buffet.
I'll mess up an omelet.
Because it's just so many options. It's limitless. It's beautiful. It's great stuff. But you didn't get up here for it.
Not at the very beginning, no. I was here pretty early, but I got a leftover, but not as fresh as I would want it to be. But still,
okay. I hear
starting
you.
The day with some protein. It was good. I had some Central Barbecue for lunch as well.
Okay.
Ooh.
All right.
It's been a good eating day for me so far.
Yeah, you may have to take a walk after the
probably
show.
Probably so.
Now, we have 3 hours to talk on the way, courtesy of 92.9 FM, ESPN, and yours truly. We're going to open on Overreaction, not an Overreaction, as we do every single Wednesday. But as far as guests are concerned, we're going to bring on Ken Wisenhunt, head coach of the Memphis Showboats. They are coming off of a 17-12 loss against the D.C. Defenders this past weekend. It was on Saturday. A tough ending. They had a field goal blocked, and they just weren't able to hold off the D.C. Defenders. But we'll talk to him about that. And I also want to pick his brain because we're getting close to NFL draft season, and he was with the Titans and also with the Arizona Cardinals. I want to know what his process was like leading up to the NFL draft. 5 o'clock, we'll bring on David Cobb from CBS Sports, and then 6 o'clock to make a big announcement regarding the winner of the 2025 Distinguished Citizen Award for the AutoZone Liberty Bowl. We bring on Steve Earhart, the executive director of the AutoZone Liberty Bowl, to drop that announcement and talk about how you can get involved, all the proceeds for the banquet, and then, of course, the golf tournament that will follow up. It's on August 24th and 25th. All of the proceeds, every bit of them, 100%, goes directly to St. Jude. So figured we'd bring him on today to announce that and get into it. At about 6:30, we'll get into the Blitz. We have some tough news regarding the transfer portal for Memphis football. They lost an offensive lineman that started for 2 years. So we'll discuss that. And I think there's some misnomers about why they lost him and sort of the discussion that is being had around it. I don't know about you, Connor, but I hear too much about tampering right this second when it comes to NIL and transfer. We have a lot of problems that are not under wraps that we have not figured out in college athletics. But tampering's one of them. And there's too many complaints for something that has no real answer right this second, that has no real oversight. But I'll explain how that process works, what it looks like. And I will say this before we even get into that. Memphis has definitely found themselves, whether it be basketball or football, in a good spot because of the lack of tampering oversight. So it goes both ways. The tampering thing cuts both ways for the University of Memphis. I want to make that very clear. Like, think of the handshake lines and P.J. Haggerty and Quante Barry and the 9 players in the last 4 years that have ended up with the University of Memphis from in-conference. I don't think that's a coincidence by any stretch of the imagination. But I want to talk about that and break it down as we get into the Blitz. But without further ado, as we do every single Wednesday, let's get into Overreaction, not an Overreaction.
All right, Gabe, last night, Jalen Wells was fouled insanely hard and dangerously by Hornets guard K.J. Simpson on a dunk. He was undercut and fell down head first and arm first. It resulted in Wells being taken off on a stretcher and a near 30-minute pause in the action. Jalen Wells spent the night in a Charlotte hospital and is now awake, alert, and has been diagnosed with a broken right wrist. The KJ Simpson foul was a dirty play. Overreaction, not an overreaction.
Listen, I think when we talk about dirty, intent has to matter. Intent means something. If you're going to call something dirty or call a player dirty, intent has to be part of it. So I'm going to say overreaction pretty heavily. I just think, personally, terrible, dangerous play by KJ Simpson. But there was no malice. He's a rookie who's 22 years old. He made a really young and foolish decision. Disgusting decision, quite frankly. And I will say, it's probably a learning experience for him. I don't know if you've seen him on social media today, but he was really distraught by the whole thing. And he was distraught on the floor last night. But here's what he said after being ejected. My prayers are with Jalen Wells. I know we already spoke and are good friends, bro. But again, I just wanted to express not only to Jay, but to his family as well, how deeply sorry I am. I would never purposefully do that to someone. I'm just extremely sorry. He went on, especially with the talent Jay is. I know he's going to be special. And just from the many times our paths have crossed, I'm blessed to know he's an even better person with an amazing story. I just wanted to say again sorry to Jay and his family, and I can't say it enough. I know God's blessings won't stop here, and more blessings are in store for Jay. Sending love and continuously praying for a fast recovery, brother. So KJ Simpson, I'm not even going to sit in here and just say it was dirty, because I think intent matters. I think it was just really foolish, really dumb from a young player. He's 22 years old.
I tend to agree with what you're saying here, because it was a dangerous play. I still think a suspension is warranted here.
It's fine. I understand.
I don't think that he intentionally went out there and tried to make a dirty play. I don't think he intentionally tried to undercut Jalen Wells. This was a young basketball player who was fighting for a spot in the league. even though it is the end of the season, he's down 20. He should have just let the dunk happen. But he went to try to make a play. He realized he wasn't going to make it, tried to get out of the way. And in doing that, he undercut Jalen Wells and created a very dangerous and scary situation. It wasn't intentional. But just because it wasn't intentional doesn't mean that there doesn't need to be some sort of punishment here.
Yes.
At the same time, that doesn't mean that he's a dirty player. And it was he was clearly impacted by it and emotional over it. And I can't lie, watching the game, it is one of the scarier things I've seen a Grizzlies player experience, because you couldn't tell if he was moving. You couldn't tell what was going on. The woman that they flashed to who was praying over him, to be quite honest, it was an emotional thing seeing that happen. I think that the players, the Hornets and the Grizzlies, the coaching staffs, the medical team, everybody handled it very well. Pete, Brevin, and Rob deserve a ton of credit
30-minute delay
for how
too.
They handled it. I also want to say that I think it's a good decision by FanDuel that they decided not to show the replay of it, because it was a scary thing to see. And that is why I think that, one, I was happy that we got the update from Jalen Wells' dad last night, so we knew that he was okay. I agree with you, though. He wasn't doing it to be dirty. It just happened to be a very dangerous and horrifying thing that happened because he was trying to make a hustle play. And the reason I think that a suspension is warranted here from the NBA, it's not about KJ Simpson. It's about that type of play as a whole.
Yes, 100%.
That does not need to happen. If there was somebody on a fast break...
Let's further prove that we need to get this out of the game, and this is not acceptable.
Especially if you're
down
20.
I'll say this. I don't think KJ Simpson will ever do anything like that for the rest of his career.
He might not ever go for a block again.
Because of how shooken up he was by it.
Right.
Whether you saw it on Twitter, you saw it on the floor last night. I don't think he'll ever do it again. But I agree with you. A suspension, whether it be one game, two games, whatever it is, I think that's still warranted to just prove to everybody. If you do something like this, there will be more repercussions on top of just how you feel in your head, in your soul. You need to feel that. You need to feel the punishment for committing a just dangerous, stupid, reckless foul.
Right. It was reckless. It was dangerous. Was it dirty? I'm not sure. And listen, we've had a player here in Memphis in recent years where you can tell that there is intention behind some of the things he's done. There are dirty plays that have happened. You know it when you see it. KJ Simpson's situation was just horrible, horrible situation. He didn't do it intentionally, but at the same time, just because you didn't do something intentionally doesn't mean that there aren't any consequences.
Yes.
And again, it's not just for him. It's to send a message across the league. Listen, y'all, if you're down 20 in a game and somebody has a fast break dunk, just let it happen, especially if he's that far out in front of you. Like, I understand that chase down blocks can be fun and they can be exciting. I'm not saying get rid of a chase down block at all. Just, if you are not even close to being there, do not undercut a player. It's one of the most dangerous things you can do in basketball.
Yes, not for nothing, notice we are shooting bail to KJ Simpson today instead of talking about breaking the code. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
Just, you know, in passing.
Dylan was a little dirty on that
but
one.
in passing, I think depending on the organization and the player, it may be a different conversation. We've seen that in the past.
I will say, though, I think a big reason why I think some Grizzlies fans and people have shown him grace is, one, Jalen Wells and his family handled this incredibly. Like, the grace that they showed him, forgiving him, making sure that people on social media knew that they had a conversation, I think is important. KJ Simpson's reaction, though, I also think matters. We saw how distraught he was. His messages on social media, those do mean something. But again, it doesn't prevent you from consequence, but I'm happy that happened.
Jalen Wells, if you saw the picture of him
in his
hospital bed, looked like he went 12 rounds with Mike Tyson. It was insane. He's got a fat lip, a bruised and cut up eye. He broke his right wrist. I will say this. It's going to be really tough for the Grizzlies to get by. I mean, he's going to be out.
One of their most important defenders.
For a long time, one of their most important perimeter defenders, and the perimeter defense has slipped. And that's why the Grizzlies have had their struggles. It's going to be really tough to get by without him. But again, that's not the most important thing. Most important thing is Jalen Wells is safe. He's awake, he's alert, and he is relatively healthy. That's the most important thing, because for a second there last night, in that 30-minute delay, I was terrified for the kid.
When they had to stabilize his head and neck, that's when it gets worrisome, because you don't know what's happening. You have no idea
is. And Brevin said this on the broadcast last night. I've never even thought about it. That was a first last night where they had to delay the game because the ambulance they had. This is how, you know, how, you know, it just doesn't happen often in the NBA plays like that, right? Where somebody has to be taken off on a stretcher. In football, it's a little different. But you had to take him away in an ambulance, and you had to wait for another ambulance to come into the stadium before you could restart the game. Like, I've never seen that in my life before. Last night, there's no precedent for that, and it was really hard to see. And you want my severe, borderline unfair reaction to the entire thing? Tanking teams are a safety hazard this time of year, aren't they? Kind of.
They can be.
You have two-way players, young guys, fringe NBA roster guys giving it their all to get good tape so they can land on a roster. And they're not really playing with a whole bunch of structure. I part of me is joking, little tongue-in-cheek with that, but part of me is a little bit serious.
Well, that
tanking teams with the type of talent or lack of talent they have and the amount of effort they're putting forward with no structure, that can be a dangerous sort of formula to end in plays like we saw last night.
Well, especially in a game like last night where it was over as soon as the ball tipped. It was over. The Grizzlies...
Wire to wire. Wire.
It wasn't even... there was no doubt from the moment the Grizzlies had their first possession that they were going to win that basketball game. And that's why it's just... In a situation like that, you've just got to let that guy score. It's when your team is down 20 and you have no momentum anyway, you're not going to miraculously come back when you have the roster that you do. I understand trying to make a hustle play, trying to give tape and, you know, be out there. Let that guy score. It's not going to be the difference of your career. It's not going to be the difference of you making it somewhere. It's one of those situations where a fake hustle play can lead to somebody being very injured.
Yes.
Very injured. It's like that was just for show. Let that guy dunk it. You're not going to catch him. I promise. So, all right, moving on. Ja debuted a new 3-point celebration last night. It's no longer a gun gesture. He has officially graduated to throwing grenades and covering his ears. This new celebration will ultimately be a problem. Overreaction, not an overreaction.
Based on the way the NBA treats Ja Morant and has treated him through this whole thing, I'm going to say not an overreaction. I think eventually it'll be a problem because what he's doing is directly just throwing everything into their face, trying to expose how hypocritical they have been toward him through this entire process, giving him a $75,000 fine for a gun gesture that everybody else does night to night in the National Basketball Association. And the fact that he had done his celebration, his gun celebration, the entire year before he played the Warriors, and then it became an issue because him and Buddy Hield were doing it back and forth, I think he is trying to expose that right now. I think this ultimately will be a problem. I have no other, no reason to believe the NBA won't step in at some point. Hopefully they don't. I'm hoping they don't. But I think this is just, as much as I know what Ja's doing, trying to prod the NBA, he's trying to go at Adam Silver and prove a point. I will say this is pretty well played. This is an interesting way to go about this, right? Because it's inherently worse and more destructive a grenade is than a gun. When you're throwing it, it's just
this is also
funny.
Stupid.
It's funny to see the way Ja played this. I think this is particularly well played if he's trying to prove a point.
Listen,
because if the NBA steps in, then it becomes a very, very big issue around the NBA.
I love it. I love it. I think it's a 10 out of 10 celebration. We already call 3-pointers bombs anyway.
He was doing it. He was going.
It's great.
Way extra.
It's great.
He's backing up for probably 5 seconds with holding his ears after he throws the grenade into the crowd.
How could this become a problem? They didn't tell him not to do it. They didn't. They said finger guns. This isn't a finger gun. It's a grenade. He could also say that it's a football. It doesn't have to be a grenade. You never know. I need you to prove that this fake grenade is a real grenade. It's like, what are we doing here? This is the dumbest thing ever. It's the dumbest thing we've ever had to talk about on this radio show. I love that he did the grenade. It's hilarious. It's 10 out of 10.
It's funny as hell.
The funny thing was I didn't notice that it was a grenade at first. I thought he was just doing hear no evil. And I was like, that's 10 out of 10 too if he was doing that.
Devin Walker's
full
tweet.
It was Devin's video and Eric tweets or whatever his name is on Twitter. When they sent it out, I was like, oh, this is incredible. I love this so much. I hope that he pulls out just swords, lightsabers, just any any weapon you could possibly think of. Because
the only reason I'm saying not an overreaction, though, is because the NBA has picked on him.
They're petty.
And they have poked and prodded at him. And he's trying to poke and prod back.
Right.
And they probably feel a little butthurt about it
eventually. But do you know how ridiculous it's going to be if they come back and they say, oh, you got to stop doing a fake grenade jammer? Like, what are we doing here? And because what I've gotten really tired of is people acting like Ja pulled out a gun on the basketball court.
Like he was threatening someone.
Right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
What are we doing? He pointed at Buddy Hield when he did it back to him. And by the way, where's the fine for Buddy Hield? How did that happen yet?
Somebody needs to clarify this for me.
The Warriors and Buddy Hield did it in the next game. I watched
it
happen.
Did Buddy Hield do it?
Yes, they all did it. The Warriors were doing it again.
And Buddy Hield should have gotten a $75,000 fine just like Ja did.
Yeah. That's why
I didn't see it directly, though. I saw Brandon Podziemski do it.
Bomani Jones, who I respect and think is great in most cases, he did a podcast today that he released, and he said, Ja's got to stop playing around with guns. It was a finger gun. What are we doing? He didn't pull out a gun on the court. We haven't seen Ja with a gun in 2 years. We have got to stop pretending like he is going full Call of Duty out there on the basketball court.
And I have to give Gilbert Arenas credit on his podcast. Yeah. He talked about it. He said it's ridiculous what they're doing.
He never broke a law.
And he was talking back and forth with his various co-hosts that sort of rotate. It's like Rashad McCants, Kenyon Martin's in there.
Rashad McCants and Kenyon Martin
were on the side of the NBA saying he's brought this upon himself. And Gilbert's like, why did he bring it upon himself? And they go, Gilbert, you did the same thing. You did the little gun gesture, and you got suspended for it.
He was like, but I pulled a gun on someone.
But he goes, dude, I committed a crime. I committed a crime. Ja never committed a crime. So, like, it's all about image with Ja. It was about actual criminal activity with Gilbert Arenas, and Gilbert Arenas pointed that out in the hypocrisy of the whole thing. So I have to give him credit where credit's due for sticking up for Ja in this situation, where a lot of people are not. I saw a Yahoo Sports article by Vincent Goodwill.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
It was a little bit too much.
I also want to say this. Ja has never once called himself a victim.
Let's be honest, he has been picked on by the NBA.
Okay, but let's be honest.
There's a fine line. I don't think he's crossed that line yet. There's a fine line between being picked on and ultimately trying to play the martyr going forward. He's right there on the precipice of just playing the martyr going forward. He's got to be careful with that line, because once you cross that line, you're going to have a complete split of NBA fans, some on your side, some not.
I'm so over the pearl clutching over this.
I agree.
People have been doing it
for years. He's done it all season. But you get what I'm saying. There is a line where sometimes we
pull back a little bit. You don't need to play the martyr. You've been picked on unfairly. I know it's hypocritical.
Sometimes the establishment needs a grenade thrown in it.
I don't disagree with that. Don't disagree.
All right, next up. Zach Edey finished with 17 points and 19 rebounds last night. He has had double-digit rebounding performances in 5 of 6 games since Tomas took over, including 3 double-doubles. Isalo has unlocked Zach Edey. Overreaction, not an overreaction.
Not an overreaction in the slightest. He became the first rookie to have 40-plus rebounds over any 2-game span since Shaq in 1993. He had 21 rebounds against the Pistons and 19 against the Charlotte Hornets. And he was playing a relatively good center in Mark Williams last night and doing all that. And I wonder if Tomas Asalo, by the way, just said, Zach, if you're next to the rim, dunk the damn ball home.
Just dunk it.
Because looking at Mark Williams, Mark Williams had no opportunity last night when Zach just went right over him and posterized him. Like, there was just nothing he could do in that situation. He had to go complain to the refs and say, why did he push me? No, he didn't. He's just 7'4". And I got to be honest with you. Taylor Jenkins, like, there's some questions I have about the way he was using Zach Edey, Connor. It's hard for me not to be curious about why he was deploying Zach Edey in the way he was, using spacing, wanting him to shoot threes, wanting him to run the floor, not giving him high ball screens. What was that? It doesn't make sense. He did that through 60-plus games. And you see in 6 games, and really the first game, Zach Edey was with Tomas Asalo, he had a double-double. It was 11 and 14 against the Lakers.
He looks like a different player.
It's like I don't understand what Taylor Jenkins was doing, because also, if you look at the history of Taylor Jenkins, it's not like he's averse to using traditional centers. Did a really good job with Steven Adams. Did a good job with Jonas Valanciunas. But Zach Edey comes in as the 9th overall pick, and he completely changes it up when he has a traditional center on the floor. I don't understand it. I think there's some tough questions eventually that need to be asked
of Taylor Jenkins about what the hell were you doing with this guy?
What's the point? What's the point of asking? What's he going to say? You going to fire me again?
I get it.
We answered the question. Hey, step into my office. You're effing fired.
I get it, but it's just strange, right? It's like it was obvious how Zach Edey needed to be used, and he wasn't doing it. It's like, was he trying to send a message? Like, that's the question I have in my head. I don't think he was. I hope that's not what the case was. But I have questions about it. And if Noah LaRoche was the reason that he wasn't running high ball screens, eventually he needed to tell Noah LaRoche, bug off. We need to run high ball screens with our 7'4", 300-pound traditional center, who is really good. He thrives in those situations. But it's not an overreaction in the slightest. He has been maximized by Tomas.
He's a different basketball player.
He's completely different. And it's not that hard to understand. What just about every offensive possession, especially in the half court, starts with a high ball screen from Zach Edey. If that doesn't work, he rolls down, sits in the dunker spot, waits for a ball to carry him off the rim. That's what he needs to be doing every time down the floor on the offensive end. It's not complicated. And it's just amazing to me that Taylor Jenkins and the rest of the staff did not do that through 60-plus games. It boggles my mind.
We talk about it all the time. Basketball, at the end of the day, is a very simple sport. And it turns out, when you put your 7'4 center next to the rim, good things happen. And when you tell that 7'4 center, hey, man, dunk the ball, good things happen. Because he's just bigger than everybody. His rebounding the last few games, I don't know if I've ever seen anything like it in a Grizzlies uniform. It's like looking at the face of God. It's amazing. It has made me so happy to see. And to your point, yeah, there are some questions that I have, and I think that we were asking them most of the season. We were like, we all feel like this isn't how you're supposed to be using Zach Edey or John Morant. Something needs to change here, because both of them look like completely different players since it happened. The melding of the two, the free-flowing offense and the pick and rolls, we saw some of that before he got fired, and that's when Ja's last 10 games have been awesome. Ja's been excellent the last 10 games. Zach Edey's been awesome the last 10 games. But there is no doubt about it that there is a before Taylor Jenkins and an after Taylor Jenkins with both of these guys. They look more comfortable out there. The synergy is there. They're throwing more lobs. And Zach Edey just looks like he is more comfortable. His defense has gotten better, too. Like, that's one thing I've noticed as well, is that his defense has absolutely gotten better. He had 3 steals last night, 1 block. He's using his size, and they're just saying, hey, man, stay down there. Don't run out to the perimeter. You're not here to shoot threes. You are here to grab rebounds, set picks, defend the rim, and dunk the ball as soon as you touch it. Another thing that I've seen from Zach Edey recently is he's not dropping the ball as much, because that was an issue. He did it a couple times last night, and that's why he had 5 turnovers. He's got to keep that ball up. You're 7'4". As soon as you touch that thing, just put it back up. That's the best thing that you could possibly do. One of the reasons Houston lost the national championship game is their big guy on a huge rebound brought that ball down and got it knocked away. Keep that ball up, Zach Edey. You're going to do great. It's just, he has got the most rebounds that a rookie's had since Shaq?
Yeah, in a 2-game span, 40.
God, I might cry.
Yeah, it's just
beautiful.
It's just amazing how painfully obvious it was to maximize Zach Edey and what you needed to do. And the fact that it took to the last 6 games once you made a coaching switch, it's amazing to me that it had to come to this for them to actually get Zach Edey going.
Yep. Next up, the Suns were eliminated from play-in contention with their loss to the Warriors. Simple prompt. The Suns are the worst failed super team of all time. Overreaction, not an overreaction.
Can I just point something out, though? They were playing for their play-in lives, postseason lives, last night, and they lost 133-95 on their home floor.
Is that bad?
Where's the fight? I understand they don't like Mike Budenholzer. Kevin Durant's out for the rest of the year. But damn, show some fight. It didn't put together this super team of Kevin Durant, Brad Beal, and Devin Booker to bow out and be 11th or 12th in the Western Conference. I can tell you that right now. And looking back at what Matt Ishbia said, when he the governor of the Phoenix Suns, what he said last year in May about, you know, I think he said 26 of 30 teams would trade for my roster right now. Well, that didn't age well. And also, you look at 29 of 30 teams in the NBA are either in the lottery or in the postseason. The only team that has is not leaning to either side is the Phoenix Suns. So it's like, what was, you don't have a plan now. Now you're just stuck at 11th in the Western Conference with no future. It's insane to me. But to answer that prompt, oh, God, people are going to go after me for this. I'm going to say not an overreaction. I'm going to say it. And the reason I say not an overreaction, because let's think about super teams with three guys pairing up, three superstars pairing up. That's mostly a 21st century thing, right? That's 2000 and on. When you look at most of the efforts at super teams, I want you to reference what happened before to create that super team, right? The Lakers and, you know, Steve Nash, Dwight Howard, Kobe Bryant. That wasn't great. They did make the playoffs, 45 and 37. They got swept by the Spurs. That was really ugly, right? It was a failed experiment. But before that, they had to move on. They were in a transition period. Pau Gasol was moving off into the sunset and finishing his career. Kobe Bryant was headed that direction. So they had to pivot on the fly. I don't blame them for putting together the quote-unquote super team that they did with Steve Nash and Dwight Howard. They had to pivot. They didn't really have a choice in that certain period of time in the Lakers franchise history. So that was a failed experiment, but at the same time, I understand why they did it. Let's go to the Nets. The Nets never have had any historical success. So when they brought in Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Kyrie Irving, at least they were right there. They were on the doorstep. They almost beat the Bucks when the Bucks won the championship, won the title, right? They were just a Kevin Durant toe away from getting in to the Eastern Conference Finals. So, failed experiment. But when you look at before versus after, that team was certainly better than what you had before. The Nets have never had any good run-ups. And let's go to the previous Nets one with all the old guys, right? It was Deron Williams and
KG.
KG and Paul Pierce. I want someone to understand, people to understand, that team won a playoff series. Like, that team got in the playoffs and won a playoff series, as bad as it was. So I look at the Suns, and the reason I put them as the worst failed super team in the modern era, really in history, is because they didn't need to do what they did to be successful. They blew up a good thing. They were in the finals. Then they were in the Western Conference semis 2 years in a row. They went 64-18. They had young guys that they could build with. Devin Booker, who's still there, of course. But then you had Cam Johnson and Mikal Bridges. And just name your guy. DeAndre Ayton was okay with them, although we didn't like him at the moment. In that moment. But the Suns were not good, or were good previous to Matt Ishbia blowing it up and going and getting these guys, Kevin Durant and Brad Beal. So, I have to say, from an experiment standpoint, this has completely failed because you had a good thing, you blew it up to do this, and it blew up in your face. That's the case I'm making. I don't think, the way they put this thing together was the worst in the world. I just think, when you look at what they had previously and what they blew up to make this happen, it was stupid. It was foolish. It made no sense.
It absolutely made no sense. One that I like that you put the modern era on it, because some people do forget that Hakeem, Barkley, and Pippen all played together, sure, and that team won 42 games. I think in terms of, because I do think that you could bring up Kawhi and Harden and Paul George, but ultimately that team still had some success, and injury was the main reason
they
that didn't happen. This team has played. They've been playing, and they just cannot win games. Now, when they put this team together, you and I were sitting here saying,
why?
First off, they have a dumbass center that's absolutely not going to work. They have no bench, and they don't have a point guard. Tell me how this is going to work. And then they brought in Tyus Jones, and we were like, maybe. And then they brought in Royce O'Neal, and we were like, maybe. But they still didn't have a center. They still haven't figured that out. And ultimately, this is one of the worst failed experiments we've seen in the NBA.
But
they all hate each other.
Going back to, I think the context matters here. Blowing up a 64-18 team 100%. To make this happen puts it in the worst failed experiment of all time to me. That's why it's in that category. And I know they made the playoffs, and I know they, competed. They were 49-33 last year, something like that. You didn't need to do this. Matt Ishbia just had this new toy when he took over as the governor for the Suns, and he loved on it too much. And you get these nasty results because of it. Exactly. He just loved on it way too much.
He killed it.
Yeah, and he killed it. He killed it. He shook it. He shook it to death. I don't know why he did it.
He Tommy Boyed it.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. Now, let's go ahead and grab a break on that note. When we come back, we need to catch up
with Memphis Showboats head coach Ken Wisenhunt. They're coming off of a loss to the D.C. Defenders. They'll be in action this weekend. We'll talk to him about all of that. You'll have a chance coming up this weekend to check out your Memphis Showboats at home in Simmons Bank Liberty Stadium. It'll be 1:30 p.m. on ESPN against the Houston Roughnecks, trying to get that first win of the season. But we bring on head coach of the Memphis Showboats, Ken Wisenhunt. Coach, how's it going?
Good. It's going good. How about you? You doing all right?
I'm hanging in there. We had some storms here in Memphis. I'm not sure if you were privy to all that, but we've had some generational flooding around the state. I think the Mississippi's about to rise pretty good here in the next week or so. So hopefully the weather holds off by the time we get to Saturday.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, for sure. But last week, tough loss at the hands of the D.C. Defenders on the road. You guys were in control of that game through about three quarters, end up losing 17-12. There was a blocked field goal late. Your quarterback, E.J. Perry, threw a pick. What type of messaging do you give to your team after a game like that where it's just like your heart's ripped out? You're right there on the precipice getting your first win of the season, and everything seems to spin out of control at the end.
You know, it's tough. It certainly is, because they fought, and, you know, right at the end we just didn't have it to pull it out. So being on the road, which, you know, all of our games are essentially on the road, but sure, it was a tough trip there. And, you know, they had a good crowd. We were fighting against that. But I can't say enough about the guys and how they fought and what kind of game they played. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't win, but we feel like we're getting better each week, and we're looking forward to this weekend.
So E.J. Perry was the guy who started, played the whole game for you, had 205 passing yards, had the late interception. We'll get to that in a second. But is that what fans should expect going forward? Is E.J. sort of the starter, or are you still sort of experimenting with both quarterbacks?
You know, I think both of them can play, and I think we'll see how it goes, you know, during each week is kind of what we're doing. And but I got to give it to E.J. He played well. You know, the interception at the end was tough, but he made a lot of plays for us. And, you know, actually productively, we were pretty good offensively. We just missed some opportunities. And I think if we can get out there and play very similar to how we did, we were a physical football team. Our guys did a good job. I think that we'll have a chance to win this week, which would be great to do that in Memphis.
Yeah. Now, E.J., with that interception, how much of sort of like going back through film, was it just a learning experience for him, something that obviously he's not going to try to do again, of course, all those things are sort of learning experiences. You worked with a lot of good quarterbacks in your day. How do you think E.J. handled that situation?
Well, you know, I think what goes unnoticed is the really good throws that he made.
Sure.
He made a number of good throws, and, you know, that's going to happen during the course of the game. And unfortunately, you know, he was just a little bit short. He was just a little bit short on that throw. Had he put a little bit more on it, it would have been good. You know, you don't really want to make a big thing about it, because that's not what you want a guy going in there to be worried about. So, you know, I think we made that point. We talked about it about this week. And when you get out there, you know, you got to believe that you can make any throw. And, I mean, obviously, we're not going to take risks that aren't necessary from that standpoint, because that is what can get you in trouble. But it was, you know, it came at a bad time, unfortunately. But E.J. played a really good game. And, you know, you can't overlook that.
Now, you guys have a blossoming star on your hands in that wide receiver room. Jonathan Adams, we already talked about him last week. But number 9 had 9 receptions for 128 yards. He has seemingly taking the baton and run with it. What can you tell me about his work ethic, what you see from him every day in practice?
Well, I keep going back to where we were in camp when he kept showing up then. You know, it's amazing, but you think about the guys that continually show up in practice and make plays, then it translates to the games. That was a lot like Larry Fitzgerald. He used to play his butt off in practice every week. And then on Sundays, which is where they, you know, they played on that league, he would make those big plays because he worked so hard. And I see a little bit of that in Jonathan Adams. Not so much am I comparing him to Larry,
sure,
but the fact that he works so hard every day and he tries to get in the right spots. And I think, too, when that happens, the quarterbacks, you know, they have confidence in you, and they're more likely to say, okay, I know this is a guy that can beat man coverage or that can do this, and I can put the ball near him and he's going to catch it. So, you know, you build a little bit of trust, a little bit of camaraderie with them, and I think that helps, too.
And obviously you want the concepts to work, but it seems like to a certain extent, everybody talks about sort of bailout guys. When you get late in the clock, your internal clock's going off, you have to get rid of the ball. How much has it been nice for EJ to have Jonathan there as sort of his bailout guy? Let me target him and see if he can make a play on the ball.
Well, there's no question. I mean, some guys you can throw a ball up to and they'll come down with it. And, you know, that's not what we count on. That's not what we anticipate. But every game is something that's a little bit different. Our line did a good job in that game from a protection standpoint. We'll have another test this week because these guys like to bring pressure and they like to play man coverage. So hopefully we'll learn from that and be even better this week. And, you know, like I said, the guys have worked hard in practice. I think they feel confident about what we're doing. You know, we're only two weeks in, and that's a big thing. As we continue to grow, I think we'll get better and better.
Mm-hmm. Now, Houston Roughnecks coming up on Saturday in Simmons Bank Liberty Stadium. Folks, get out there and enjoy yourself. Should be a nice day. It'll be 1:30 p.m. If you're going to watch it on TV, it'll be on ESPN. But what have you seen from the Houston Roughnecks that you're going to have to sort of corral or take advantage of to go ahead and get a win?
Well, I think the biggest thing for us is offensively, we've got to be able to have some success against their defense. They're a physical group. They're big. They got a big defensive line. They're not afraid to play man coverage. So, you know, we've got to be able to handle those things and then make some plays with it. Our defense is doing a really good job. I think, you know, been very pleased with what these guys are doing. And I think that in an environment that we hope to be in, that we'll have a good time. We'll have a good chance of really making it tough on them to score. And then hopefully we'll be able to open up some things on offense and score some for ourselves. That's what we want to do. Like I said, you know, I'm really, really pleased with how these guys are working, and hopefully this is going to be the game where it really shows what they've been doing.
And certainly there should be some opportunities. And obviously I know the Roughnecks are going through this in practice, going through the film, trying to correct these things, but there have been some opportunities where they put the ball in harm's way. How much do you think your defense, as opposed to, you know, the first two defenses that the Roughnecks played, how much do you think your defense can take advantage of getting the ball away, getting more opportunities for your offense?
Well, I go back all the way through camp when we were going against our defense every day. And, you know, you knew that they were a competitive group and they have a lot of pride and they work hard. So, you know, we're excited that they're playing another team, our defense is, besides us in practice. So hopefully they'll show you what they can – you get a glimpse of what this defense can be this weekend. Like I said, they've had a good start this season, and we got to continue with that. But I'm excited to see how they will play against this team.
Now, I'm gonna switch gears a little bit because, you know, in the National Football League, where a lot of your roster, a lot of your guys hope to get to here at some point, they're putting tape out there. Hopefully they can get to that level. That's something that you guys push out and you encourage. You want that to happen. But you were formerly with the Titans, formerly with the Arizona Cardinals. When it comes to the NFL draft process, since we're in draft month, is it as hectic on the inside as it seems from the outside when it comes to all the rumors and everything you have to deal with from coaching, personnel, staff, the front office? How much do you have to deal with when it comes to NFL draft month and the lead up to the NFL draft?
Well, you know, it's such a popular sport and everybody is so interested in it. It's always going to be difficult because, you know, it's you're not, when you go to a town and you work out a player, everybody knows about it. So sure, they know that now you're interested in this player. And, you know, that happens because a lot of times that's what you have to do. You got to go find out about these guys. It's not, you can't get everything you need from tape. So you have to spend some time with them and see really what they're all about. So then people get an idea, okay, they want this guy because they've come to visit him. And really the process is about trying to find the right fit for you. And just like anything, you've got to go to a lot of different players to find the one that you think fits your system the best. So, you know, there's just so much information out there about who's good, who's not good, who's going to go high, who's not going to go high, that you just have to block it out as a scout or as a coach, because you have to really pay attention to what these guys can do and how they can help you in your system. That's what's so important. And, yep, you know, I think it's important that you get a chance to spend a little bit of time with these guys. Because when I was in Pittsburgh, you know, it was always, you have to become us. You have to, yeah, you know, we are the Steelers. You have to become one of us. So, you know, they're always looking for the right kind of fit from a standpoint of how they're going to fit in the locker room. So, you know, there's a lot of it that goes into that, but you just never really know for sure. So you got to do as much as you can research-wise on finding out about these guys and how they fit for your team. And then, you know, that's what we're so excited about. I'm so excited about with the UFL is that, you know, these guys, if they come out and they play well and they do some good things like Jonathan Adams, you know, maybe they'll get a shot at the NFL. And, you know, you can stand up and say, this guy can play. And, you know, that'll mean something because they've gone against good competition. So not to get off subject.
Sure.
You know, it's just a parallel to, I think it's great that, you know, you get a chance to work with these guys and maybe give them a chance to move up into the league.
How is that evaluation process? Because I know that the NFL checks out the UFL. They signed, what, 83 players last offseason or whatever it was. A lot of players. And some guys have made some big differences on their NFL clubs. But how is that evaluation process throughout the season? Do you take calls from coaches and scouts and NFL personnel on certain players you have? How does that work?
Well, not right now because okay. They're so daggone busy with their draft. But, yeah, it does happen. I think it happens more towards once they get through with their draft and then they're looking for players, especially, you know, before they go into camp that can help them, that can come in and compete. You know, and I think what they're doing is building a resume by how they play. Our guys are, which is important. You know, you will get calls from coaches or from personnel guys asking about a player on your team, which mm-hmm. that lets you know that they're interested in these guys. And we get a lot of those kind of calls because those guys are working hard to try to fill their team out and build it with some of these guys. So it's exciting to see what this product, the UFL, can do to help, you know, these guys get to the NFL.
And just to highlight it, you guys are very transparent about those calls, I would assume. You talk about it with the player that has been called about, very transparent with that process?
Well, I think the players know that. I think they know if they come in here and they play well, you know, against this level of competition, that they're probably going to get a look by the NFL. And, you know, we've seen that happen. It's not something that happens, you know, every once in a while. Like you just said a minute ago, there were a number of guys that came out last year. There'll be a number of guys this year when this season is over that will get into NFL camps. And hopefully, you know, some of the things that we're doing can help them to move to that. That's what, you know, the whole thought behind that is.
Now back to the NFL draft. It's become a buzzword in this day and age when we lead up to the NFL draft, the word smokescreen, or the term smokescreen, I should say. And I don't know if you have any examples or any stories you'd want to share, not forcing you to do that, but how real is that? You have certain guys you may want to take in the first round and you're trying to throw off the scent. So certain PR people, you're leaking things behind the scenes. How real is the sort of smokescreen culture around the NFL draft?
Well, I think there's some players that you really like, you know, that you really think can help your team, but they may not be in the area where it's going to be the first round pick. So,
sure.
You know, that's when you start saying, throwing off the smokescreen, we're not interested in this guy, or, you know, that we don't know that he can fit into what we do, when actually he can, and you're hoping he's there when you pick. But, you know, so there is some of that, but the evaluation process, you're doing so many guys, and then you come in a room and everybody, you know, talks about it, trying to get who's the best. It's difficult to mask from externally, I mean, internally, what you're going to do. But from externally, you have to, because you certainly don't want somebody to come in and swoop up your pick.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, I think that, you know, it is, I don't know how widespread it is, but there are some teams that do it.
Yeah. And also, final thing, how hectic is a draft day war room? Obviously, it's 3 days now, but how hectic is that situation? Everybody throwing out their thoughts, especially as you get to the later rounds. Really, anything
well,
first round
crazy.
On.
It is absolutely crazy when you get to the later rounds. It really is, because you're trying to fill needs. You like a guy, you know, you don't know that you're going to be able to pick him until maybe two picks later, and you're scared to death somebody else is going to grab him because you've invested all this time in scouting him. It becomes a big deal. You know, the first round picks that are going, it is really more about, you know, masking who you're going to pick in the first
sure.
round, but you pretty much have an idea of who's going to be there. Now, every once in a while, somebody that you really thought was going to be gone is there, and then you have to take him just because his grade was so high. But as it gets later in the draft, it really becomes hectic from the standpoint you're calling guys, you're saying we're potentially going to pick you in the next round, you know, trying to get their interest in you, trying to feel them out if they've had any calls from other teams. You know, things like that. So you can maybe say, we got a chance on this guy or we don't. I mean, there's a lot of that going on. So it does get pretty hectic.
Yes, sir. Well, Coach, I appreciate you joining. As always, we'll do it again next week. And good luck coming up this weekend.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yes, sir. He is Showboats head coach Ken Wisenhunt. The Showboats will be in action trying to get their first win against the Houston Roughnecks coming up on Saturday, 1:30 p.m. It'll be on ESPN, but you can also go get tickets. It'll be in Simmons Bank
Liberty Stadium. Now let's go ahead and grab a break on that note and get into hour number two, where David Cobb will join us off the top. We'll talk about the national champion Florida Gators, and we'll get into the offseason in college basketball. Should be a fun one to look forward to, but he's next.